Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 47.
So the three Taoist preceptors have been defeated.
Right.
But the king is still, well, he's a mess. The text says he's weeping all night, mourning these guys as if they were, you know, loyal human ministers. He still doesn't get it.
And that's where Wukong steps in. He sees the king crying and is pretty blunt about it. He's like, why are you crying? Those weren't humans. They were animal spirits. Simple as that.
Doesn't just say it, though, does he? The text gives us that that crucial detail. Wukong tells the king, go get their bones.
Yeah, pull out the skeletons. And when they do, well, there's no arguing then. The text is specific. One's a tiger skeleton, one's a deer, and the sheep power guy, an antelope.
Right. Wukong even asks, where do humans have skulls like that? It makes it clear they were...
mountain beasts.
Exactly. Mountain beasts who'd become demons, basically. Achieved sentience. Gained powers. That detail's important. They weren't just animals. They were evolved demons actively deceiving the king.
And Wukong reveals there was more to it than just deception, right? There was a hidden danger.
Oh, yeah. He tells the king they were waiting.
Waiting? For what?
Waiting for the king's... his sort of vital fortune or destiny to weaken. So it wasn't just about gaining influence. They were playing a long game, timing a complete takeover based on, like, the king's predicted cosmic decline.
A takeover? Seriously?
That's what Wukong says. He spells it out. They plan to seize the whole kingdom in just 2 more years, right when the king's ki was expected to dip.
So Wukong emphasizes they got there just in time.
Precisely. He makes sure the king understands this wasn't random. Their arrival literally stopped the kingdom from falling into demon hands.
And that finally gets through to the king. His officials check the bones, confirm it all, and the king finally understands how badly he was fooled. He's grateful, throws a banquet for them, and importantly, issues a decree to recruit Buddhist monks. A total turnaround.
It's a huge shift. And there's that nice little touch where the 500 monks they'd freed earlier show up.
Oh, right. To thank Wukong?
Yeah, they heard the policy change. And they come back to thank him properly and return those magic hairs he used to help them. A nice little callback.
It really shows the impact they're having. And Wukong gives the king some parting advice, too, doesn't he? Like a mini lesson in ruling.
He does. It's really key advice, actually. He tells the king, basically, you need to respect all three teachings now, Buddhism, Taoism, and nurturing talent, you know, capable people.
Treat everyone fairly, value ability.
Exactly. If you do that, Wukong says, your kingdom, your kingdom will be secure forever. Hashu. It's a lesson learned the hard way after being tricked by those Taoist imposters.
Makes sense. So with that sorted, the team finally leaves Chechi Kingdom, back on the road.
Back on the road. And the text immediately tells us time is passing. Spring turns to summer. Summer fades into autumn. They've been traveling a fair while since the city.
Right. Doing their usual thing, traveling by day, resting at night, eating when hungry. The standard routine. Until one autumn evening, Tang Sanzang asked the practical question.
Kaharase Kupiyu, where are we sleeping tonight, disciples?
A perfectly reasonable question.
Absolutely. But Wukong's response is, well, it's very Wukong. He contrasts the ordinary person's life, warm bed, family, that earthy detail again.
Right. He contrasts that with their life. Traveling under the stars, eating winds, sleeping rough, basically saying, we're monks on a quest. We don't stop just because it's dark.
But then Baji chimes in. He's like, hold on, brother.
Yeah. Mm. You only know half the story.
He brings it right back down to earth. The roads are tough. His luggage is heavy.
Yeah, yeah. He says he needs proper rest, needs to find a place, sleep well, or he just won't be able to manage the next day.
Can't argue with that, really. He's got a point.
He does. So Baji's practical need wins out. They decide, okay, let's push on just a bit further in the moonlight, see if we can find somewhere soon.
And just as they're walking along, hoping for shelter, they hear something.
A sound, yeah. The text says, do-do!
The roar of waves, big waves! Instantly they know it's a river. Blocking their way.
And Tang Sanzang immediately asks, how on earth do we cross this?
Good question. Baji, ever the pragmatist with physical stuff, says, let's chuck a stone in, see how deep it is.
Tang Sanzang's a bit unsure, but Wukong's like, go on then.
So Baji grabs a rock, tosses it in, and the sound tells the story. Sinks right down, stirs up bubbles.
Deep?
Deep, deep, deep. Baji's verdict is immediate. Can't cross too deep.
Okay, so it's deep, but... how wide? Baji can't tell.
But Wukong can try. He leaps up, uses his fu, his fiery eyes.
His special vision, yeah.
And this is where it gets serious. Wukong mentions, you know, normally he can see 1,000 light. That's maybe 300 miles during the day, maybe 300 to 500 light at night. Pretty far.
Incredible range. But here?
Here. He looks, and Tang Sana, he cannot see the other side at all.
Wow. Even his eyes can't see across it.
That tells you everything. This isn't just a river. It's immense. The text describes it like the sea. Endless. Windless. Wind. Just vast. Moonlit water. Waves churning.
And Tang Sanzang. How does he take this?
He's completely taken aback. Speechless for a moment, the text says. And when he finally asks Wukong what they'll do, his voice is choked up. He's clearly distressed.
You can feel the despair starting to creep in again. But then Xia Sang spots something.
Yeah, by the water. Thinks it might be a person, maybe a fisherman. Could help.
Wukong goes to investigate, cautiously. But it's not a person.
No, it's a stone tablet.
And it has writing on it.
It does. Big characters first. Like, well, Tongtian River.
Tongtian River, okay.
And then smaller characters underneath.
Which means?
800 li across. Few have traversed it since ancient times.
800 li, that's, what, nearly 300 miles wide? And hardly anyone has ever crossed it.
That's what the tablet says. And when Tang Sanzang sees that, he just breaks down. Starts weeping again.
Oh, the poor master.
He laments how he thought leaving Chenyan was the hard part, never imagining these endless demons and these vast waters, just obstacle after obstacle.
But right as he's feeling hopeless, they hear something else.
Mm-hmm. Drums and cymbals off in the distance.
And Baji, always thinking of his stomach, says, hey, sounds like someone's having a religious ceremony. Let's go get some food and ask about a ferry.
Practical as ever. Find food. Find a boat.
But Tang Sanzang recognizes the sound more specifically.
He does. He says, wait, that's not Taoist music. That sounds like our monks holding a service.
So maybe fellow Buddhists nearby?
That's the hope. So they follow Wukong towards the sound. The text mentions they're walking over rough, sandy ground, not really a path.
And they find a village.
Yeah, a settlement.
Yeah.
But about 400 or 500 households, the text estimates.
And the description sounds quite peaceful. Almost hidden.
It does. Lawn tucked by the mountain, near the riverbank. Quiet. Gates closed. Bamboo fences. Not many lights. And the scent of white water flowers on the wind, it feels quite secluded.
Like a little world unto itself, right there by the Tongtian River.
Yeah, they found the spot near a house. And right away, the text flags that there's religious activity. You know, flags, lights, incense.
Okay, so some kind of ritual is going on.
Seems like it. And this immediately gets Tang Monk thinking. He's the master. Always cautious.
Right, especially when dealing with, well, potentially pious people. He needs to handle it carefully.
Absolutely. He knows his disciples can cause issues, so he makes a call.
He tells them to wait outside.
Yep. He says he'll go first, ask for lodging from the householders, the Piet.
And he's pretty direct about why, isn't he? He mentions their faces.
He does. He says, ugly or maybe unconventional. He doesn't want them scaring people right off the bat and messing things up.
It's practical, but it really shows that their appearance is like an immediate problem in normal society.
Definitely. So Tang Monk goes up to the gate. It's partly open and calls out.
And an elder comes out. He's reciting Amitabha, apparently on his way to close the gate.
Tang Monk greets him, very polite. But the elder totally gets the wrong idea.
He thinks he's just another monk looking for leftovers from the ritual.
Exactly. He starts listing what they already gave out. Rice, cloth, some copper cash. Like, sorry you missed it.
But Tang Monk quickly sets him straight. Not here for alms.
Right. I'm from the Great Tang, the East, heading west for scriptures. Just need a place for the night.
And the elder's reaction, disbelief.
Total disbelief. He's like, Great Tang, that's... what, 54,000 miles away?
Which is an enormous distance, like thousands and thousands of miles.
Unthinkable for one person. So he asks, how could you possibly travel that far alone?
And boom, Tang Monk drops the reveal. Not alone.
Got three disciples. And he uses that amazing phrase, Inyufa.
Open mountains when they meet mountains, build bridges when they meet water. Basically, they can handle anything.
Exactly. They're his muscle, his protection. That's how the journey's possible.
It emphasizes their power, doesn't it?
Right.
Kind of contrasts with the social awkwardness Tang Monk's trying to manage.
Big time. But focusing on their ability, not their looks, seems to work, at least for now. The elder invites them in.
Okay, so the plan sort of worked.
Sort of. But then reality hits. The text describes the disciples Wukong, Pigsy, Sandy as impatient, rough, reckless.
Right. Routine is the phrase, right? Like they just don't think.
Exactly. No regard for propriety.
Yeah.
Master calls, they hear him and whoosh.
They just burst in with a horse and luggage.
Like a gust of wind, yeah. And the result is, well, exactly what Tang Monk was trying to avoid.
The elder sees them up close.
And completely loses it, falls down screaming,
"Monsters have come."
Oh, man.
That gut reaction, pure terror. Doesn't matter what Tang Monk just said about their skills. The look is overwhelming.
So Tang Monk has to rush over, help the poor guy up.
Yeah, trying to calm him down. No, no, not monsters. They're my disciples.
He admits they look bad, T.
Appearance isn't great, basically, but he immediately pivots back to their powers, subduing dragons, taming tigers, catching demons.
Look past the scary faces, see the abilities. It's a hard sell, though.
It really is. The text says the elder is kind of believing, kind of not. He's trying to square the polite monk with these creatures.
And meanwhile, the disciples, they just keep going.
Oh, yeah. They barge right into the main hall where the other monks are chanting, deep in their ritual.
Oh, this is going to be good.
It's pure chaos. The monks look up, see Pigsy's snout and ears, the others. And the text just says,
"No one wasn't afraid."
They drop everything. Instruments clang, mallets, bells. They forget the Buddha images, blow out the lights in panic.
And just scramble to get out.
Totally. Falling over each other, bumping heads. The text uses this great image. Aha, like a collapsing gourd rack.
Ruining the whole sacred atmosphere. The
completely demolished. And the disciples. Wukong, Pigsy, Sandy.
What do they do?
They think it's hilarious. Start clapping and laughing out loud.
Oh, that's not going to help.
Makes it worse. Oh. The monks scatter even faster. It shows, you know, it's not just how they look. It's their total lack of awareness. They treat this solemn place like a joke.
Right. Their whole energy is just wrong for the setting. Wild.
And then Tang Monk arrives, finds the hall dark, empty, except for his disciples cracking up.
He must have been furious.
Absolutely livid. He lays into them. Unruly things. Utterly bad.
Strong words.
Very strong. Calls them, "You are the lowest, most foolish kind." He quotes some classics about how hard it is to teach the inherently foolish.
Wow. And his main point is?
That they ruined the householder's good deed, the ritual. By scaring everyone off, they messed up the host's merit.
And brought sin onto him. Tang Monk.
Yeah, yeah. That's heavy. He's saying their bad behavior reflects directly on his own spiritual standing.
That must have shut them up.
Instantly. Dead silent. It shows his authority, right? Even though they're way stronger physically.
And seeing that the scolding, the disciples actually obeying that, convinces the first elder.
That's the turning point. And he finally believed they were his disciples. He sees the control.
So he tries to smooth things over.
Yeah, plays it down. Oh, it's fine. Ritual was ending anyway. Lights just went out. Being polite, trying to recover.
But just as things maybe calm down.
Pigsy.
Always Pigsy. His mind is on one thing.
Yep. He just blurts out, "Where's the post-ritual meal? Let's eat and sleep."
Uh-huh. So the elder calls for lights again.
He does. The servants are confused. Like, weren't there just lights? But they come out with torches.
Don't tell me.
Yep. Round two, they see Pigsy and Sandy again, panic, drop the torches, slam the inner door.
And yell monsters again.
You got it. The fear is house-wide now.
So who gets the lights sorted?
Wukong. Ever practical. Picks up a torch, lights the lamps properly. They finally get seats arranged.
Okay, progress. Then another elder shows up.
Yeah, an older one with a cane. Clearly the head guy. He heard the noise and wants to know, what evil demon is this?
And the first elder runs interference.
Quickly steps in. No, no, not demons, he explains again, calling them Dasaka.
Arhats from the great Tang seeking scriptures.
Yeah.
That's a promotion.
It's the elder trying to put a respectable spin on it. An Arhat is an enlightened being, right? Way better than monster.
And he repeats that key phrase.
He does. Appearance is false, but they are truly good people. He's convinced now, based on what he saw.
And the second elder buys it.
Seems to. Puts down his cane, greets them formally, calls for tea, calls for food.
But the servants are still terrified.
Shaking in their boots. Shaken! Really hesitant to get close.
And Pigsy, of course, notices they're not serving fast enough.
Asks why they're running away. The elder explains, they're waiting to serve you.
And then Pigsy starts demanding specific numbers of servants. This is amazing.
It's classic Pigsy. 8 servants for 4 guests isn't cutting it for him.
Let me guess. One for the master.
Two for Wukong, the hairy-faced thunder god-mouthed one.
Nice description. Eight for Sandy, the unlucky-faced one.
And for himself, a cool 20.
20 servants. Why?
Because his appetite, his gut, is bigger. He just states it as fact.
The elder just notes his appetite. Doesn't argue.
What can you say? So somehow they rustle up 30 or 40 servants?
Tables are set. One for Tang Monk, three for the disciples.
And one for the elders. And then comes the food. A massive vegetarian spread. Fruits, veggies, noodles, rice, snacks, soup. Sounds incredible.
But here's the contrast again. Tang Monk starts praying.
Reciting a scripture before eating? The very proper, very spiritual.
Hand painting.
Doesn't wait 1 second, grabs a bowl of rice, and inhales it. Like, God!
A servant sees this. Asks if he, like, held it in his mouth.
Yeah, like maybe he spilled it. Pigsy's just like, nope, ate it.
And proves it by doing it again.
Instantly swallows another bowl. The servants are just amazed.
They say his throat is like, what was it?
With grinding bricks, truly smooth and slick. It's this perfect image of like horrified admiration for his eating ability.
How many bowls does he down before Tang Monk even finishes praying?
Five or six, the text says, just warming up.
So the meal gets underway for everyone.
Yeah.
And Pigsy just goes wild.
Total free-for-all. Scooping and gorging on everything, constantly yelling for more rice.
Does anyone try to rein him in?
Wukong, surprisingly, tells him maybe slow down, save some room. You know, better half full than starving.
Sensible advice. Pigsy's response.
He quotes the saying, Wuchu, better to bury a monk alive than not feed him till he's full. He's twisting it.
Completely.
Yeah.
Using it to justify stuffing himself, it's the host's duty to fill him up.
How do the elders react to this bottomless pit?
They explain, pretty politely, that they usually only have a little leftover food after the ritual for neighbors and stuff.
But since the disciples scared everyone else off.
All the food is for them. And they even offer to steam more if needed, still being incredibly hospitable despite everything.
And Pigsy's reaction.
Steam more, steam more. Absolutely zero hesitation. His focus is purely on getting fed.
Wow. What a scene. Pigsy confused.
This ritual looks off somehow.
Yeah, he asks the elder about it.
Right, he thinks it might be one of those Buddhist things he knows, like preemptive storage of merit, maybe, or preemptive repayment.
Things you do for the afterlife, basically. But the elder says, no, no, it's a preemptive funeral ritual.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
Pigsy points out, you know, you don't usually have a funeral for someone who's still alive.
Exactly, that's the hook. It immediately tells everyone, the travelers, and you listening, that something's really not right here. Something is deeply wrong in this village.
Definitely. They're at the river.
Saw the stone tablet with a name. But the elders mentioned they actually missed something nearby.
Oh. What's that?
Just about a line away, apparently there's the Lingan Great King Temple. They walked right past it.
Ah, the local deity's place. So they start explaining about this. Lingan King. What does Lingan mean again?
It means sensitive or perceptive. And you know, at first the description sounds pretty good. Positive, even.
Okay, like what?
Well, they say his influence gets temples built for him. And his power protects the local people, you know, far and wide.
So, protection. What else?
Annually, he brings sweet dew, which means rain, good for the crops, and auspicious clouds, good omens, prosperity.
Right. Sounds like a standard benevolent local god then. Protector, brings fertility, everything you'd want.
Exactly what you'd think. But as the elders are saying all this, they start getting upset. The text says they're distressed, even weeping.
Oh, so there's a catch. A big one, I'm guessing.
A huge one. This is where it flips. They say, though much grace, there is also resentment. Even though benevolent, it harms people. Powerful line.
Wow. Even though benevolent, it harms people. That says it all. So what's the harm? What's the price for all this grace?
He demands a sacrifice every year.
What kind of sacrifice?
A virgin boy and a virgin girl. Human sacrifice.
Oh, no. That's horrifying.
And the text, the elders speaking, they don't mince words. They say straight up, just because it wants to eat virgin boys and girls, it is not a clear and upright God.
So they know he's not righteous, despite the rain and stuff. They're under no illusions.
None. They know he's monstrous. But they also believe that if they don't make the sacrifice, he'll send misfortune, disaster. They're trapped.
It's a terrible bargain. Protection and rain. But the cost is their children. And this particular year, the lot has fallen on this family, the Chens.
Yes, which explains the preemptive funeral. It's for the children who've been chosen. The elders doing the ritual are the two heads of the household, brothers. Chen Sheng, he's 63.
Okay.
And Chen King, he's 58. And they make a point of saying how hard it was for them to even have children.
Really? How so?
They say their combined age is 120 years, right? Between them, in all that time, they only managed to have two children, just one each.
Wow. So these kids are incredibly precious after waiting so long and hoping.
Yeah.
And now these are the ones demanded. Who are the kids?
Chen Cheng, the older brother, has a daughter. She's 8, named Yi Chengjin.
Yi Chengjin. Does the name mean anything?
It really does. They explain they spent 30 jin of gold, that's one pichul, a huge amount on charity before she was born. Basically, a massive offering trying to earn the merit to have a child.
30 jin of gold, just for the hope of having her. That's staggering. And the other brother, Chen King.
He has the son, 7 years old, named Chen Guanbao.
Guanbao. Any story there?
Yeah. They prayed for him specifically at the altar of Lord Guan, you know, Guan Yu, the famous general turned god.
Ah, okay. So both kids represent this enormous longing, huge expense, spiritual effort, and these are the two the great king wants to eat.
You can just feel the agony coming off the page, can't you? Their only descendants, the future of their family line, gone. The funeral ritual is because, well, they see them as already lost.
It's absolutely brutal. And then Monkey steps in, right? Ever the practical one.
Yes. He hears all this, sees the despair, and asks, well, a very monkey sort of question. He asks about their wealth.
Right. Are they poor? Is that part of the problem?
Quite the opposite. The elders list everything. I mean, loads of land. 40 or 50 king of wet fields, 60 or 70 dry. That's enormous.
Okay. So they're landed gentry, basically.
Big time. Plus 80 or 90 grass fields, hundreds of cattle, horses, donkeys, tons of pigs and chickens, grain stores, clothes. They admit it. They're very wealthy.
So Monkey hears this, and he's probably thinking.
Exactly what you'd think. He says, hang on, if you're so rich, why don't you just buy some other kids?
Offer substitutes, yeah. Seems logical, if horrifying in itself.
He even suggests prices, like 50 liang of silver for a boy, 100 for a girl, less than 200 total, a pittance compared to their assets. Save your own kids, save your lineage.
You'd think that would be the first thing they'd try. Surely someone would sell a child for that kind of money back then.
Well, that's the thing. They explain why money is completely useless here. And this goes back to the king's name, Lingan. Sensitive, perceptive.
Ah, so he's not easily fooled.
Not at all. They say he's very sensitive, very perceptive. They never see him, apparently. Just smell this fragrant breeze when he's near.
Creepy.
But he knows everything that goes on in their households, like down to the smallest details, matters as small as a spoon or bowl, the text says. It's incredibly invasive.
Okay, so he's aware. How does that stop them buying substitutes?
Because he doesn't just know stuff. He knows people. Specifically, he knows everyone's birth dates. Their birth months.
Right.
And she only accepts the children designated by the lot, the natural-born children of the families chosen, who are the right age and presumably the right birth month for that year's sacrifice.
Oh, so you can't just grab any kid of the right age. It has to be the specific child chosen by whatever system they use.
Exactly. They state it outright. Even if they offered thousands, tens of thousands of liang, they couldn't buy a replacement that would match the exact birth requirements.
The king would know. So their wealth is totally irrelevant to this particular problem. It can't buy off fate or trick this incredibly perceptive entity. That's a chilling limit on earthly power.
It really is. It locks them in completely. Sacrifice their own longed-for children or face disaster. That's the choice.
Until Monkey, right? He sees money won't work, so he thinks differently.
He asks to see the boy, Chen Guanbao.
And what's he like?
Just a little kid, 7 years old, playing with some fruit. Totally oblivious to, you know, the fact that he's scheduled to be eaten. It's heartbreaking.
Just pure innocence. So Monkey sees him.
And decides on a plan, a very Sun Wukong plan. He mutters a spell, shakes himself, and transforms.
Into the boy.
Perfectly. Not just looking like him. The voice, the clothes, the size, everything is identical. The text even adds this detail that he weighs exactly the same.
Wow. A perfect copy. How does the family react to seeing this?
They freak out. They're terrified, fall to their knees, start begging him to change back. They think just witnessing that kind of powerful magic might shorten their own lives.
Those how scared they are of the supernatural in general, not just the nasty king.
Definitely. But Monkey calms them down, changes back, and basically says, see, perfect double. And he asks them, you know, would this work for the sacrifice?
And what did they say?
They're overjoyed. Suddenly there's hope. They say, yes, yes, he'd be too good even. A perfect substitute seems possible now.
So Monkey offers himself up.
He does. He says he'll take Guan Bao's place, go to the temple, save the kid, save the family line.
That's incredibly brave. Or maybe just incredibly confident in his own power. How does the family respond to the offer?
Immediately, Chen King, the boy's father, offers 1,000 liang of silver. Huge amount.
Okay, finally showing some gratitude with their wealth.
Yes, but he offers it to Tang Sanzang, the master, for travel expenses.
Ah, not to Monkey directly.
Right, which leads to this slightly funny moment. Monkey kind of says, hey, aren't you going to thank me? I'm the one doing the dangerous part.
Huh. And what's their logic?
It's grimly practical. They basically say, well, you're going to be eaten by the great king. You'll be gone. Why thank someone who's about to disappear?
Oh, wow. They just assume he's doomed. They don't grasp who they're dealing with here.
No, not at all. But Monkey just finds it amusing. He scoffs. He dares eat me. Like, the idea is ridiculous. He accepts the deal. Eaten or not, he'll go.
So he agrees to be the sacrifice, setting up this amazing confrontation. Money couldn't solve it, but maybe magic can.
Exactly. The king's power was based on knowing the specifics, demanding the authentic child tied to fate. Monkey's bypassing that with a perfect supernatural forgery. It's not about tricking the rules. It's about challenging the deity's perception itself.
Yes, it's a really stark contrast. Chen King, the boy's father, as, well, grateful for potential help. He immediately offers silver. It suggests maybe a desperation, or perhaps he's resigned to it, hoping for any way out.
Hmm. Okay, so that's Chen King. What about Chen Cheng, the girl's father?
He's completely different. The text describes him just leaning against a door, weeping.
Oh, man.
And his reason, it's heartbreakingly specific. He says he has no son, just this one daughter, Yi Cheng Jin.
His only child.
His only child. And he just can't bear to lose her. It seems tied to his lineage, his future.
Wow. Okay. That really grounds the stakes, doesn't it? It's not just a ritual, it's personal devastation.
Exactly. It highlights that personal cost and maybe, you know, some societal pressures around heirs that the text points to.
Right. And into this heavy scene steps Sun Wukong.
Always the one with the plan, or at least an idea.
So what's his opening gambit?
Bold. Direct. Wukong quickly decides, nope, we got to save both kids.
Okay. So who takes the girl's place?
Well, who else? He looks straight at Zhu Baji.
Oh, no. Baji, how does he react to being volunteered?
Huh. Not well. Not well at all. The Sora says he's greatly alarmed.
I bet.
He immediately protests, says Wukong is being reckless, trying to drag him into danger. Unfairly, he claims.
What's his excuse? Does he have one?
Oh, he has a list. It's actually quite specific. He says he can transform into, like, big things.
Big things.
Yeah. Mountains, trees, stones, elephants, buffaloes, even fat men, he says.
Yeah.
But transforming into a small girl, oh, no. That's uniquely difficult for him, apparently.
Difficult. Or is he just scared, trying to get out of it?
Knowing Baji from the rest of the story, it feels very much like a convenient excuse. Self-preservation kicking in, you know?
Right, right. He doesn't want to end up on the Spirit King's dinner plate.
Precisely. But then the master, Tang Sanzang, steps in.
Ah, the moral compass. What does he say?
He actually backs Wukong. Reminds Baji of that saying, saving a life better than building a 7-story pagoda.
Framing it as good karma.
Exactly. An opportunity to gain merit, repay the villagers' hospitality. He even, kind of strangely, suggests they should just play around doing this.
Play around. Facing a child-eating monster. That's optimistic.
It is Sanzang, after all. But his point is clear.
Yeah.
Do the right thing, Baji.
So does Baji cave?
Well, Wukong doesn't really give him a choice. Despite Baji's protests, Wukong just insists. Tells Chen Cheng, the girl's father, bring her out.
Bring out Yi Cheng Jin so Baji can see her.
Yeah, for the transformation reference. And this is where the source gets incredibly specific.
How so?
It doesn't just say a girl. It describes her whole outfit. An 8 treasure flower headpiece.
Wow.
A red and yellow silk jacket. A green satin cloak. Red silk skirt. Red silk shoes.
Wow.
Even gold knee guards.
That's incredibly detailed. And what's she doing amidst all this drama?
Eating fruit. Just casually eating some fruit while her fate hangs in the balance.
That image is something else, the normalcy against the terror.
It really makes a hit home, doesn't it? So Baji sees her. Time to transform.
And how does that go? Does he manage it?
He tries.
Yeah.
He definitely tries. But according to the text, only his face changes.
Just the face.
Yep, the body. Still recognizably Baji. Fat and awkward, the source says.
Ah. So Wukong's reaction must be priceless.
Oh, it is. Immediate frustration. He calls it not male, not female. Basically, a total fail.
So what does Wukong do? Yell at him?
Nope. No time for that. He just sort of steps in and fixes it. Blows an immortal breath on Baji. And poof. Instantly, Baji's body matches the face. He looks exactly like the girl. Problem solved.
Just like that. Wukong's magic versus Baji's attempt.
A clear difference in skill level, let's say.
So now they have two imposters ready. What next?
Wukong gives the family instructions. Quick, clear. Get the real kids inside.
Right. Hide them.
Feed them some good fruit, another one of those specific details, and keep them absolutely quiet.
Don't want the Spirit King getting suspicious.
Exactly. And then the source describes how they're actually presented, the method of sacrifice.
How does that work? Are they tied up?
Not at all. It's really weird. They're placed on red lacquer plates.
Plates, like dinner plates.
Big ones, presumably, set on top of tables. And then four young men carry the tables.
They're carried out on plates. That's bizarre. How does Wukong react to this?
He finds it hilarious, actually. Shows his odd sense of humor even now. He calls them upper crust monks.
Because they're being carried in style.
Yeah, like dignitaries being chauffeured to their doom. He seems quite amused by the formality of it all.
And Baji. Still amused.
Oh, definitely not. He's terrified. The text says he immediately gets it. Being on a plate means...
being eaten.
Exactly. The penny drops. This is real. He's the main course, potentially. Mm-hmm. And Baji is, you know, understandably freaking out a little.
Does he say anything to Wukong?
Oh, yeah. He voices his big fear. Getting eaten.
And Wukong's advice is...
classic Wukong logic. Just watch me. When the Spirit King starts eating me, the boy... that's your cue. Run for it.
Simple enough, unless...
unless, as Baji immediately asks, what if the Spirit King fancies the girl first?
Right. That's a critical point for Baji. What if he's the appetizer?
It's a valid concern. And this leads to another one of those fascinating specific details from the source.
How do they know the eating order? Did someone leave a Yelp review for the Spirit King?
Almost. It comes from the villagers themselves.
The villagers knew. How?
Properly. Some were brave enough or maybe foolish enough to hide during previous sacrifices.
Well, they'd wear...
behind the temple or under the supply table, the text says, just to watch.
They spied on the monster while it ate children. Wow, that's intense.
Intense, right. And they came back with intel.
What was the key finding? Boy first or girl first?
The intel is definitive. The Spear King eats the boy first, then the girl.
Boy first, meaning Wukong.
Meaning Wukong is first on the menu.
And Baji's reaction to this news.
Pure relief. The text captures it perfectly. Good fortune, good fortune.
And he's safe. For now, Wukong takes the hit.
His fear instantly dialed back a notch. For a moment, anyway.
But just as they get this crucial bit of info, things start happening.
Yeah, the timing is perfect. The main group of villagers arrives. The atmosphere shifts.
How so?
The source mentions gongs, drums, and lights. It sounds like a procession is starting.
Right, the ceremony proper.
And the final moments in this passage are really about that handover. The villagers demand the children.
Do we see the fathers again?
We see an old man crying. Likely one of the fathers, probably Chen Cheng, his grief still raw.
Ugh, tough. And then?
Then the four young men step up, lift the tables with Wukong and Baji on their plates.
Carrying them off.
Carrying them out towards the temple and the waiting Spirit King.